I felt that this invitation must have great significance for us and, in fact, it turned out to be the starting point on the road that led me into intimacy with the young God King. On the appointed day we put on our fur coats, bought the most expensive scarves we could find in the town, and, in the midst of a gaily clad crowd of monks, nomads, and women in their festal garb, climbed up the long stepway to the Pokhara. As we climbed, the view over the city became more and more impressive. From here we looked down onto the gardens and the villa-like houses. Our road led us past countless prayer wheels, which the passers-by kept in movement. Then we passed through the great main gate into the interior of the palace. Dark corridors, their walls decorated with paintings of strange protecting deities, led through the ground floor buildings to a courtyard. From the steep ladders, several stories high, took one up to the flat roof. The visitors climbed them carefully and silently. Up above, a dense crowd was already assembled, as everyone has the right to receive the Great One's blessing at the New Year. On the roof there were a number of small buildings with gilded roofs. There were the apartments of the Dalai Lama. With monks leading the way, a long sinuous line of believers moved slowly toward a door. We too came directly after the monks in the line. When we came into the hall of audience, we craned our necks to get a sight of the living Buddha over a forest of heads. And he, too, momentarily forgetful of his dignity, looked up eagerly to get a glimpse of the two strangers of whom he had heard so much. In the posture of the Buddha, leaning slightly forward, the Dalai Lama was sitting on a throne covered with costly brocade. For hours he had to sit and watch the faithful filing by and bless them as they passed. At the foot of the throne lay a mountain of money bags and rolls of silk and hundreds of white scarves. We know that we must not hand over our scarves directly to the Dalai Lama, an abbot would take them from us. When we found ourselves standing with bowed heads before the presence, I could not resist the temptation to look up. An eager, boyish smile lit up the charming face of the Dalai Lama, and his hand raised in blessing was laid for an instant on my head. Everything happened very quickly. In a moment or two we were standing before a somewhat lower throne on which sat the regent. He, too, laid his hand on us in blessing, and then an abbot placed red amulet scarves on our necks and we were asked to sit down on cushions. Rice and tea were served and, obedient to the custom, we threw a few grains onto the ground as an offering to the gods. From our quiet corner we had a wonderful view of all that went on. An endless host of people filed by the young God King to receive his blessing. With their heads bowed in humble obeisance and their tongues hanging out, they presented a strange picture. None dared look up. A light touch with a sort of silken mop replaced the laying on of hands with which we and the monks had been honored. None of the visitors came empty-handed. Some brought only threadbare scarves, but there were pilgrims with a retinue of bearers laden with gifts. Every offering is immediately registered by the treasurer and, if usable, added to the household stores of the Pokhara. The numerous silk scarves are afterward sold or given to prize winners in athletic contests. The money offerings remain as the personal property of the Dalai Lama. They flow into the gold and silver rooms of the Pokhara, in which immense treasures have been accumulated for centuries and inherited by one incarnation after another. More impressive than the gifts is the expression of intense devotion on the faces of all these people. For many it is the greatest moment of their lives. They have often come many hundreds of miles on their pilgrimage, throwing themselves in the dust and sometimes walking on their knees. Some have spent months and years, and suffered greatly from cold and hunger on their journey to receive the God King's blessing. It seems to me that a touch from the silken mop was a meager reward for such devotion, but one could not but recognize the expression of supreme happiness that lit up their faces when a monk laid a light scarf on the neck of each pilgrim. They carry these scarves to the end of their lives in lockets or sewn into wallets and deem them to be a protection against all evil. The quality of the scarf corresponds with the status of the recipient, but each of them has the mystical triple knot. These knotted scarves are prepared by the monks, but for ministers and the most highly placed abbots the Dalai Lama ties the knots himself. The atmosphere of this crowded room, filled with the scent of incense and the smell of the butter lamps, became very oppressive as time went on, and we were glad enough when the ceremony came to an end. As soon as the last of the pilgrims had left the room, the Dalai Lama rose and, supported by his servants, proceeded to his private apartments while we stood motionless with bowed heads. As we were leaving, a monk came up and handed to each of us a crisp new 100 sang note saying, "Jai Alpa Rinpoche Kisori, this is a gift from the noble king." We were greatly surprised by this gesture, more especially when we learned that no one had hitherto received a gift in this form. It was typical of Lhasa that everyone in the town knew of the honor that had been done to us before we had mentioned it to a soul. We kept these notes as talismans for many years, and when we finally left Tibet we had to admit that they had not disappointed us. After the audience we took the opportunity to visit the numerous holy places of the Potala in company with the pilgrims. The Potala, one of the most imposing buildings in the world, was constructed in its present form some 300 years ago by the 5th Dalai Lama. Previously there had been on this site a fortress belonging to the kings of Tibet, which had been destroyed by the Mongols during one of their invasions. From a faraway quarry, gangs of forced laborers carried stone after stone on their backs to the building site, unassisted by any technical devices. Skilled stone masons created the present palace. When the 5th Dalai Lama suddenly died, there was a danger that the work would never be completed, but the regent, who could not count on the people's loyalty to himself to finish this formidable work, withheld the news of His Holiness's death. It was first announced that he was seriously ill and then that he had withdrawn from the world for meditation. This deception was continued for 10 years until the palace was finished. Today, when one looks at this unique building, one can understand and excuse the fraud that made its completion possible. We found on the roof of the Potala the grave of the ruler to whom the building owes its origin. The remains of the 5th Dalai Lama rest in a shrine near those of the other god kings. There are 7 of those tombs before which monks sit and pray to the muffled sound of drum taps. If one wants to reach the stupas, Buddhist shrines, one has to climb up steep ladders, a dangerous venture. There is little light to see by, and the rungs are slippery with the dirt of centuries. The greatest stupa is that of the 13th Dalai Lama, which is built several stories deep into the palace. Over a ton of gold was used to supply the gold plate with which the walls of this tower are faced. After visiting a number of temples, we came to the western part of the Potala, where 250 monks are lodged. Namji Tratzang, as this section is called, is narrow and full of corners and not inviting to the European eye, but the view from its little windows makes up for the gloomy and inconvenient interior. I could not help thinking how attractive Lhasa, with its cubical houses and flat roofs, looked from this eminence. We were too high up to see the dirt in the narrow streets. In the following years, I had several opportunities of staying in the Potala as the guest of friends who lived there. Life in this religious fortress resembles, one supposes, that of a medieval castle. Hardly an object belongs to the present day. In the evening all the gates are closed under the supervision of the treasurer, after which watchmen go through the whole palace to see that everything is in order. Their shouts, ringing along the corridors, are the only sounds in the oppressive stillness. The nights are long and peaceful. Everyone goes to bed early. In contrast to the brisk social life in the city, there are no parties or entertainments. From the shrines of the holy dead emanates an atmosphere of mortality, dim and solemn, which makes the whole palace feel like an enormous tomb. I could very well understand that the young ruler was happy when he could move to his summer garden. A lonely child without parents or playmates must lead a dreary life in the Potala. He found distraction only in the rare visits of his brother Lobsang Samten, who brought him greetings from his parents and told him all the news of the town. The Dalai Lama possesses an elephant, the only one in the country, which was presented to him by the Maharaja of Nepal, in whose country there are many religious adherents of the god king. Many Nepalese enter the monasteries of Tibet and devote their lives to religion. They form separate communities in the cloisters and are reputed to be very apartment pupils. The Maharaja originally gave two elephants to the Dalai Lama as a token of his respect, but one of them did not survive the journey over the Himalayas, though the 700-ma road to Lhasa was carefully cleared of stones. Special stables were prepared at all the halting places for these beasts, one of which, at least, reached the capital in good shape, to the great satisfaction of everyone. No one had ever seen so gigantic an animal. They called him Langjin Rimpok. He had a house to himself on the north side of the portal and, festooned with precious brocade, often took part in processions. Riders, whose horses were not accustomed to such monsters, gave him a wide berth. During the New Year celebrations, the father of the Dalai Lama died. Everything conceivable had been done to keep him alive. Monks and medicine men had tried every kind of remedy. They had even prepared a doll into which they charmed the patient's sickness and then burned it with great solemnity on the riverbank. It was all to no purpose. To my way of thinking, they would have done better to call in the English doctor, but of course the family of the Dalai Lama must always be a model of orthodoxy and must not swerve from traditional practice in times of crisis. The body was taken, as usual, to a consecrated plot outside the town where it was dismembered and given to the birds to dispose of. The Tibetans do not mourn for the dead in our sense of the word. Sorrow for the parting is relieved by the prospect of rebirth, and death has no terrors for the Buddhist. Butter lamps are kept burning for 49 days, after which there is a service of prayer in the house of the deceased. And that is the end of the story. Widows or widowers can marry after a short time, and life resumes its wonted course. In 1947, Lhasa had a minor civil war. The former regent, Retting Rimpok, who had voluntarily resigned his office, seemed once more ambitious for power. Retting had many adherents among the people and the officials, who stirred up ill feeling against his successor. They wanted to see Retting back at the helm. They decided on action. The coup d'état was to be effected by the modern expedient of a bomb. This was delivered as a present from an unknown admirer in the house of a high monastic official, but before the parcel reached the regent, the infernal machine exploded. Luckily, no one was killed. It was through this unsuccessful outrage that the conspiracy was disclosed. The energetic Tagtra Rimpok acted with speed and decision. A small army led by one of the ministers marched to Retting's monastery and arrested the former regent. The monks of the cloister of Serra revolted against this action, and panic broke out in the town. The dealers barricaded their shops and took away their goods for safety. The Nepalese took refuge in their legation, carrying with them all their valuables. The nobles shut the gates of their homes and armed their servants. The whole town was in a state of alert. Ofsnator had seen the columns marching toward Retting and came at top speed from his country home into the town, where he and I organized the defense of Zarong's mansion. People were less preoccupied with the political crisis than with the fear that the monks of Serra, who numbered many thousands, would break into Lhasa and pillage the town. And there were others who had no confidence in the army, which was to some extent equipped with modern weapons. Military revolutions were not unknown in the history of Lhasa. The arrival of Retting as a prisoner was awaited with excitement, but in the meantime he had been conveyed secretly to the Potla. The monks, who had planned to set him free, were deceived by this action, but, in fact, from the moment that their leader was arrested their cause was lost. Strong in their fanaticism, they refused to surrender and wild shooting soon began. It was not until the government bombarded the town and monastery of Serra with howitzers and knocked down a few houses that the resistance ceased. The troops succeeded in overpowering the monks, and peace returned to the capital. For weeks the authorities were occupied in bringing the culprits to justice, and many severe floggings were inflicted. While the bullets were still pinging through the town, the news of the death of the rebellious ex-regent spread like wildfire among the people. Whispered rumors went around about the manner of his death. Many thought he was the victim of a political murder, but more believed that by dint of concentration and his inflexible will he had projected himself into the next world without the formality of dying. The town was suddenly full of the most unbelievable stories of the miracles attributed to him and of the superhuman powers he possessed. On one occasion, when a pilgrim's earthenware cooking pot was boiling over, he is said to have closed it in with his hands by drawing the sides over the top, just as if the clay had been still soft and plastic. The government refused to confirm or deny the rumors. Probably few people knew what had really happened. The late regent had made many enemies during his term of office. On one occasion he caused a minister who was plotting a rebellion to have his eyes put out. Now he had paid for this crime. As usually happens during political upheavals, innocent people often had to pay the penalty for the guilt of others. The former protégés of Retting were dismissed from their posts. One of the prominent men in his party actually killed himself. This was the only case of suicide that I heard of during all my stay in Tibet. The prison had not room enough for all the condemned persons, so the nobles had to take the responsibility for lodging them and keeping them in custody. As a result, one found in almost every house a convict in chains with a wooden ring around his neck. It was not until the Dalai Lama officially assumed the power of a ruler that an amnesty was granted to political and common law offenders. Most of the monks of Sera had fled to China. It usually happened that when there was a rising in Tibet, the Chinese had a finger in the pie. All the property of the rebels was confiscated by the government and sold at public auction. The houses and pavilions of Retting Rinpoche were demolished, and his beautiful fruit trees transplanted into other gardens. The monastery was thoroughly ransacked by the soldiers, and for many weeks afterward gold cups, brocades, and other valuable objects kept turning up in the bazaars. The sale of Retting's property realized several million rupees for the treasure. Among the effects were hundreds of bales of English woolen goods and 800 costumes of silk and brocade. This shows how rich one could become in Tibet. Retting was a man of the people with no background. His career had started when, as a boy, he was recognized as an incarnation. Commissions from the government. The religious ceremonies held in commemoration of Buddha's birth and death during the fourth month of the Tibetan year gradually obliterated the memory of the rising. In the autumn we were invited by the government to draw up a new plan of the town. Ofsnator interrupted his work, and we began to make a survey. No proper plan of the city had ever been made. In the last century, secret agents from India had brought some sketch maps home with them, but they had been drawn from memory and were quite inaccurate. Now we were able to make use of Zarong's theodolite, and with our measuring lines went through all parts of the holy city. We could work only in the early morning, for, as soon as the streets began to fill, we were surrounded by a swarm of curious people. We had been given two policemen by the government, as we could not keep the people off by ourselves. But even so we had difficulties. The passers-by found it interesting to look into Ofsnator's survey glass, from the wrong end, of course, and our operations were considerably hampered. It was no pleasure to trudge through the filthy streets in the biting morning cold, and we needed the whole winter to collect the material for our survey. We had to climb onto the roofs, so as to be able to mark out the houses in the different blocks, and I had to collect more than 1,000 different names of householders, and in the Tibetan script. When the copies were ready for the Dalai Lama and all the important government offices, a new parlor game was introduced. People learned how to read the plan and amused themselves by spotting their own houses on it. At this time the government had the idea of installing a modern drainage and electric system on which they wanted to employ Ofsnator and me. Neither of us had studied the technique of these subjects, but my comrade had an excellent knowledge of mathematics, acquired while studying to become an agricultural engineer and, of course, when in doubt we had recourse to the relevant textbooks. Ofsnator was already being paid a monthly salary in rupees, and I received my appointment as a salaried official in 1948. I have kept my letter of appointment and am still proud of it. A few months after our audience with the Dalai Lama, I was summoned in the middle of the night to the Norbulinka Palace and informed that the rising waters of the river threatened to overflow onto the summer palace. The monsoon rains convert the gently flowing stream with uncanny speed into a rushing river, in places more than a mile wide. When I arrived on the scene, I found the old embankment on the point of giving way. In pouring rain and by the faint light of lanterns, the bodyguard, under my directions, set to work to build a new dike. We managed to strengthen the old dike sufficiently to keep it unbreached for the moment, and the next day I bought up all the jute sacks that were to be had in the bazaar and had them filled with clay and sods of turf. 500 soldiers and coolies worked at high pressure, and we were able to erect new defenses before the old dam burst. At the same time, the weather oracle was summoned from Gadong, and during the following days he was my neighbor in one of the houses in the palace grounds. Both of us had the same mission, to control the floods. It was fortunate that we had not to rely solely on the oracle and that we had an alternative force of 1,000 hands at work. Just as we were throwing the last spadefuls of earth on the dam, the oracle tottered onto the bank and went through his dance. On the same day, the rain stopped, the floods receded, and we both received the commendation of the Dalai Lama. I was afterward asked if I could do something of a permanent nature to the dam the floods that threatened the summer palace every year. I willingly agreed, as I felt confident that with Orf's Nata's help I could find some means of controlling the flood water. I knew that the Tibetans always built their dikes with perpendicular walls and realized that was why they breached so easily. We began to work in the spring of 1948, and had to complete it before the monsoon. I was given a force of 500 soldiers and 1,000 coolies. No contractor in Tibet had ever had so many hands. I insisted on another innovation and convinced the government that the work would be completed much more quickly if forced labor were not employed. So every man received his pay daily, and good humor reigned in the works. Of course, one cannot compare the productivity of Tibetan workers with that of Europeans. The physical strength of the natives was much inferior to that of our workmen. They looked with astonishment at me when I impatiently took a spade and showed them how to dig. And there were many interruptions and pauses. There was an outcry if anyone discovered a worm on a spade. The earth was thrown aside and the creature put in a safe place. The low productivity of the people must be due to their insufficient diet. The poor man lives generally on sampa, butter tea, and a few radishes with some paprika. The whole day long they were brewing butter tea in the works, everyone got his portion, and soup was served out at midday. In addition to my soldiers and coolies, I had a fleet of 40 yak skin boats. The boatmen, who are associated with the skins of animals and are, consequently, in conflict with the tenets of Buddhism, are regarded, like the leatherworks, as second-class citizens. An example of the way in which they are treated remains in my recollection. One of the Dalai Lamas on his way to the monastery of Samyad crossed a pass over which the boatmen always used to go on their way to the river. The pass became sanctified by the passage of the God King, and from that time onward on boatmen was allowed to use it. With their boats on their backs they were obliged to climb over a much higher and more difficult pass with a corresponding waste of time and energy. The boats weigh over 200 pounds and the passes are always higher than 16,000 feet. That gives one an idea of the extraordinary power of religion in Tibet over the daily life of the people. It always saddened me to see men trudging by with their boats on their backs. They marched upstream along the bank with slow and measured steps. They could never have rowed against the current. Every boatman was followed by a sheep with a pack on its back. The sheep, as well trained as a dog, needed no lead, and when its master took to the water again it would jump into the boat by itself. The 40 boats employed on the building of my dam had to bring granite from a quarry that lay upstream from us. This was no easy task for the boats, their sides had to be strengthened with boards to prevent the stones from breaking through. The boatmen were men of fine physique, and their pay was higher than that of the other workmen. I noticed that they were not so humble as other second-class citizens. They had formed a guild of their own and were proud to belong to it. A happy chance ordained that the Bonpo of Tradun should be one of my collaborators. His duty was to pay the wages every evening. We had the best recollections of each other and often talked about the time when we were in Tradun, a wretched time for me. Today I could laugh about it, When we first met, he was on a tour of inspection with 20 servants and treated us with courtesy and friendship. Who would have thought that one day we should be working side by side and that I should be, more or less, his chief? I often could not realize that 4 years had passed since our first meeting. 4 years in which I seemed to have become half a Tibetan. I often caught myself making typical Tibetan gestures, which I saw 100 times a day and came unconsciously to imitate. As my work served to protect the garden of His Holiness, my chiefs were monks of the highest rank. The government, too, took great interest in my activities. On several occasions, the whole cabinet rode out to see the works with their secretaries and servants, and complimented both of us on our success, besides giving us scarves of honor and presents of money. On these occasions, the workers were also given money and were granted a half holiday. My dikes were actually ready in June, just in time, as the first floodwater came down soon after. That year the river was very high, but the dikes did their job. On the land that used to be flooded, we planted willows, whose fresh green leaves gave an added beauty to the summer garden. While I was at work erecting embankments to protect the Garden of Jewels, I was often invited by high monastic officials to supper and to stay the night. I was certainly the first European who was permitted to stay in the Potala and the Summer Garden residence. Thus I had more opportunities to admire the beautiful grounds and the splendid fruit trees and conifers that had been brought from all parts of Tibet. A host of gardeners looked after the flowers and trees, and kept the paths in order. The park is surrounded by a high wall, but it is accessible to visitors wearing Tibetan dress. 2 men of the bodyguard inspect arrivals at the gate and see to it that no European hats or shoes find their way into the park. They obligingly exempted me from this rule except for the garden parties, when I used to sweat under the weight of a fur-lined hat. The guard present sums to nobles of the 4th rank and upward, and I also got a salute. In the middle of the park is the private garden of the living Buddha, surrounded by a high, yellow wall. It has 2 gates strongly guarded by soldiers through which, apart from His Holiness, only the abbots appointed as his guardians may pass. Not even cabinet ministers are admitted. Through the foliage one can glimpse the golden roofs of temples, but the cry of the peacocks is the only sound that escapes to the outside world. No one knows what happens in this inner sanctuary. Many pilgrims come to visit this wall and follow a path that leads clockwise around it. At short intervals there are dog kennels built into the wall, whose savage, long-haired tenants bark when anyone comes too near. The yak hair leashes prevent the dogs from attacking, but their hoarse growling sounds a discordant note in this peaceful world. Afterward, when I was privileged to enter the secret garden through the gates in the yellow wall, I made friends, as far as one could, with these rough fellows. Every year dramatic performances are given on a great stone stage outside the inner garden. Vast throngs of people come to see the plays, which go on for 7 days from sunrise to sundown. They are performed by groups of male actors and are almost entirely of a religious character. The actors are not professionals. They come from the people and belong to all sorts of professions. When the drama week is over, they go back into private life. The same plays are performed year after year. The words are sung in a kind of recitative, and an orchestra of drums and flutes sets the rhythm for the dances. Only the comic parts have spoken lines. The beautiful and valuable costumes belong to the government and are kept in the summer palace. One of the 7 groups of actors, the Jiayu Malungma, is famous for its parodies. It was the only group that I was really able to appreciate. One could not but be astonished at their frankness. It is a proof of the good humor and sanity of the people that they can make fun of their own weaknesses and even of their religious institutions. They go so far as to give a performance of the oracle, with dance and trance and all, which brings down the house. Men appear dressed as nuns and imitate in the drollest fashion the fervor of women begging for alms. When monks and nuns begin to flirt together on the stage, no one can stop laughing, and tears roll down the cheeks of the sternest abbots in the audience. The Dalai Lama witnesses these performances from behind a gauze curtain at a window in the first floor of a pavilion in the inner garden, behind the yellow wall. The officials sit in tents on either side of the stage. At noon, on their way to a common meal prepared in the kitchen of the Dalai Lama, they file past the window of the ruler,